I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Chuck Close, one of America's leading contemporary painters. He's known mostly for his oversized portraits. Close up, his paintings seem like abstract increments of color, but when one steps back, a precise representational head emerges. Chuck started painting when he was 5 years old, and despite his learning and physical disabilities, his paintings are the darlings of leading museums and art collectors. His works hang in New York's Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney, and the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., among others. Welcome. I'd like to understand how you got here, and I'd like to start with your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the state of Washington, of very modest means. My father was a kind of jack of all trades, itinerant inventor, and he'd been very ill his whole life. And he went to work for the Army Air Corps and later the Air Force because he needed health insurance. And my mother was a classically trained pianist who had had hopes of performing, and but the Depression came along and sort of wiped out that the possibility.
And were you an only child?
I was an only child. My father's an only child, and my mother's an only child. Both of them are dead, so I have none of my original family left at all.
Did you feel special as a child growing up in any way?
Well,
I
had really unusual parents. A real role reversal. My father, because he was so ill and sickly, did most of the things that women did. He cooked and baked, and my mother mowed the lawn and fixed the car. And I was very severely learning disabled. Long before I was physically disabled, I was learning disabled. But as anybody who was alive in the 40s and 50s know, there was no such thing as learning disabilities or dyslexia. Then you were simply dumb and lazy and a shirker or malingerer. But even from a very early age, I knew that I wanted to make things for other people to see. So I did puppet shows and magic acts and other things to sort of entertain the troops. And also the first thing that I felt good at, better than my friends, was draw. Everyone needs to feel special, and I was so bad academically and clumsy and unathletic. So luckily, I got a tremendous amount of support from my family, and they helped me. They really made me feel special and appreciated.
So you had a healthy self-confidence despite your mm-hmm. learning disability.
Art saved my life academically as well, because the most important thing you can do as a learning disabled student is show your teachers that you are interested in the material and in the course, even though you're not going to be able to spit back the names and dates and things in the test.
So you charmed your way into a B?
I did, and I'm not all the way to the B, perhaps, but so I would schlep in a 20-foot-long mural of Lewis and Clark Trail as extra credit to mitigate for my poor performance in history class, for instance.
How did you then go from Washington to the East Coast?
I'd always said if I hadn't gone to Yale, I could have gone to jail. either way, it was a toss-up.
You got into Yale because you were considered special at the University of Washington, and there was a summer program at Yale mm-hmm. that you applied for.
You know, in life, when people say that someone is focused, I think more often than not what they're really saying is that you're narrow. Mm-hmm. And because I wasn't good at anything else and had all my eggs in this one basket, I distinguished myself from my classmates by being hungrier, caring more, and working harder. It wasn't that I was any more talented than most of the rest of the students, and talent is a dime a dozen anyhow. But at any rate, I think I just knew that if I couldn't make this art thing work, there was no fallback position. There was nothing else I was any good at.
Right. And you didn't necessarily wallow in your misery about being learning disabled. You just sort of put that aside and said, all right, I'm just going to suck that up and look straight ahead.
Well, I've always been an optimistic person, a positive person. And I think many of the coping strategies that I evolved as a learning disabled student put me in good stead to cope with having become a quadriplegic. Many of these coping strategies are things that they now teach mm-hmm. learning disabled people, but I sort of evolved them on my own.
You, in 1988, had an artery collapse in your spine, mm-hmm. causing you to be disabled. And had somebody predicted that prior, that this would have happened to you, would you have predicted that you would have been able to get through this so strongly?
It's very hard to predict who's going to be able to handle something and who isn't. Sometimes the person you most assume would be able to cope with it crumbles and falls apart, and someone else who's always seemed sort of weak and not particularly strong all of a sudden rallies and actually ends up being much stronger than anybody had any reason to assume. In my particular case, I think I've always known you can have a winning hand and find a way to lose it, or you can have a losing hand and find a way to make it work for you and win.
I always say that 10% of life is what happens to you, and 90% of your life is how you respond to it.
Mm-hmm. I always have said about being an artist that inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work. I mean, if you're sitting around waiting for the clouds to part and to be struck in the head with a bolt of lightning in order to be inspired enough to go do something, you're probably never going to get anything done. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you just get to work, all sorts of things will occur to you through the process.
You seem very practical to me, and obviously very eloquent and well-spoken. It's hard to believe that you do have a learning disability.
Learning disabled people are often very articulate because, first of all, we're not dumb. We just have problems. We have deficits. If you're not destroyed by your learning disabilities, you're probably going to be a pretty strong person. And you have to be charming as hell because you are faking your way through life. You're not going to, I don't remember anybody's names. I don't remember anybody's faces. So I'm sort of floating through life, not knowing, where I'm at and who I'm talking to. So I have to be very charming and seductive in order to have things work out well for me. So a large percentage of successful dyslexics and learning disabled people, that they're articulate and they can convince people, to take a chance on them.
I love that you are bold enough to admit that you are charming.
It's one more coping mechanism. I mean, I know how to be charming. Maybe it's even fake, but I know how to do it. I know how to turn it on.
All right, well, we'll see if I'm charmed by the end
okay.
of this interview.
You'll be the judge of that, right?
Right. Yeah. Did you ever try to take any drugs for your learning disability?
I wasn't diagnosed with them until relatively late in life. I did try one drug. It made me feel awful. But at this point, I am who I am. I'm extremely lucky. I do what I want to do every day of my life, and I manage to get paid to do it. So I don't have any real desire to change anything much.
I want to go back to something you said. You said you don't remember people's names or their faces,
right.
Yet your entire job is focusing on the face.
I'm sure every aspect of my work was driven on one hand, one degree or another, by my learning disabilities. For instance, I don't recognize faces, but if I commit something to a flat surface, then I have virtually photographic memory. So I have to take this person who I don't recognize walking around, and I have to flatten them out and make that an image that I can. So I'm sure that I was driven to make portraits to commit to memory the images of people that I know and care about. I was overwhelmed by the whole. And so I broke everything down into small bite-sized pieces, which is why I make my work incrementally. There's an aspect of what I do that's also like what used to be called women's work, knitting, crocheting, quilting, whatever. And these activities are very calming. It's a little bit like raking gravel in a Zen Buddhist garden. So it's no accident that I gravitated towards what I do.
And you're also a self-proclaimed Slav, but your paintings are, I guess in the increments, they could be perceived as messes of color, but they are precise and require a lot of patience. And you've also said you're impatient. Is it a form of therapy for you?
Well, people who know me really well can't figure out how I ended up doing what I'm doing because they know that I have no patience and no attention, short attention span, and I have, and I'm a slob and a nervous wreck, all of which would seem to preclude making work like what I make. But I didn't want to be held captive by my nature. I didn't want to think there's only one kind of art I can make because that's who I am. Big, sloppy, messy, tentative paintings. So I thought to construct a situation in which I would not be able to wallow in my nature is also to deal with my nature. I'm just going to construct limitations which will not allow me to do what seems so self-indulgent.
Can you tell me a little bit about your family life now? You are married with two daughters?
Yes. I met my wife when I was teaching in Amherst, Massachusetts in the 60s. She was an artist, and we moved to New York together. And she's now a landscape historian.
And her name's Leslie.
Which is actually my father's name, too. All important people in my life were named Leslie. Almost immediately I got to Amherst, I realized what a terrible mistake I'd made because I really wanted to go to New York instead. An interesting thing took place. I thought I could be a teacher and an artist. So at the beginning, I was an artist who also taught. By the end of the first year, I was a teacher who also made art. By the end of the second year, I was a teacher who used to make art. So I learned very quickly that this was not going to make me happy. And that I better get my butt to New York, where I really wanted to be all along, and just try to pursue, making paintings and survive somehow.
Well, lucky for you that you had that realization in your mid-20s than in your mid-70s.
it's really fortunate in my case that I have known for virtually my whole life exactly what I wanted to do, that kind of single-minded pursuit of it didn't leave much room for doubt. But I know many, many people who are still in their 40s and 50s trying to figure out what they want to do.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the painter Chuck Close. We'll hear more from Chuck coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is the painter Chuck Close. He's known for his paintings of heads, and in the 1960s and 70s, the heads were more photorealistic. Over the past few decades, he switched to a more abstract, colorful form of painting. The process seems a little more random, and the painting is in the form of colorful increments, but the result is precise. His paintings hang in New York's Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney, and the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. I want to go back to your early days in the 60s and 70s when painting was becoming less popular. You've said before that you think there's no better time to make painting than when others think painting is dead.
Well, I've been around long enough to have painting be dead already several times in my career. And I do think that that's a time when it's a particularly good to be a painter, you know, because you probably are making work for your own reasons rather than larger global art world reasons that something is hot or not. Anytime you chase what's hot, you are chasing. You are behind the pack. Whereas if you do what you want to do and follow it wherever it goes, the buffeting winds of change that blow through the art world won't affect you very much. And you won't be tempted to simply try and make this month's hot product.
So let's take for a second that you don't follow the whims of the market and you don't necessarily paint to please your customers. How do you expect to make a living?
Well, you know, I never expected to make a living from my work. And, you know, one of the very few artists do. I mean, 99.99% of artists have to have some other kind of career to support their profession. I couldn't have been more surprised when it turned out that we could, in fact, sell a 9-foot-high painting of someone else. Who would want one? It didn't make sense. I never anticipated that these things would sell. The only person who was even more surprised than me was my dealer, who also thought it was impossible. But I'll tell you this, had I attempted to make decisions based on financial success, I would have made all the wrong moves. I definitely would not be where I am today had that been a goal. There were other aspects of success that were far more important to me. Recognition, getting my work out in front of people, critical success. I wanted to be taken seriously. I wanted the work to be seen, but it frankly never occurred to me that I would be financially successful. And in fact, I don't really care about money, and I think that's one reason why I have so much of it. if that's what you're trying to do, you'll make very different decisions. For instance, instead of making a 9-foot-high portrait of someone else, I would have done commissioned portraits. I would have been painting college presidents and CEOs.
So who was the first person that wanted to buy your 9-foot painting?
Before I ever had a solo exhibition in New York City, I'd sold to museums. I didn't want my work to just be the plaything of wealthy people with a lot of discretionary extra income to spend. I really wanted them out in front of people of all financial means. My very first sale was to the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, an incredible museum.
Was that Martin Friedman?
Martin Friedman, yeah. Bought the first painting for $1,300. Took 2 years to pay for it, $650 a year for 2 years. The Whitney bought my fourth or fifth one. From the very beginning, I had that kind of institutional support, which surprised the hell out of me.
So you said your first painting sold for $1,300. Mm-hmm. Did you price that painting?
Mm-hmm.
And why $1,300?
Well, I'll tell you exactly why we did it. We kept the prices extremely low in order to put them into public collections, because institutions have a little bit of discretionary funds to buy art, not very much. And if things get too expensive, you price yourself out of a museum's range. And then you have to depend on wealthy people to buy it and give it to a museum. So we artificially kept the prices very low in order to place them.
Great business decision, Chuck.
I guess. And am I charming yet?
You're working on it.
I'm working on it. Okay. You're probably not going to believe this, but I swear that it's true. I don't know what my paintings sell for now. I let my gallery make that decision in order that there's no connection between what I do and the money that comes in. The work leaves the studio and money comes in, and in my mind, there's virtually no connection between the two. Fantasy, I suppose, that there's no connection, makes it easier for me to convince myself that I'm simply going in the studio to do what I love to do best. I remember once my accountant said to me, you can't afford to make drawings. And I said, what? What do you mean I can't afford to make drawings? He said, well, you make much more money when you're making paintings. And I said, don't ever, ever say anything like that again, because I don't want that in my head. I don't want to think which of these activities pays off financially, which ones don't.
But inherent in that comment that you don't even know how much your paintings go for is a degree of trust. I mean, you really have to trust the people that you're working with. because you don't know how much of the money is coming in, and you just assume that you're getting a check.
Well, and there are times when the work didn't sell at all, and then I, because I take a stipend from my gallery, after a while I realized that I was in debt to the company store, you know, and there have been times when they owe me money, and there's times when I owe them money, but it's part of the kind of self-deception, I suppose, that I find works well for me, that I need to disconnect the activity I love from the financial success that I've achieved.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch, and I'm talking to Chuck Close, the painter of heads. He started off doing more photorealistic paintings, and he's moved on to his famous incremental paintings. There's a quote that resonates with me. You said that you made these paintings so big because you thought, the bigger they are, the longer it takes somebody to walk past them in a gallery. And you wanted to grab them by the lapels and say, love me, hate me, but look at me. It's like the plaintive cry of a small child of most artists saying, I'm here, I made this stuff, won't you please look at it? But somewhere in there seems to be an inner confidence that if people do look at it, they are going to like it.
What is more narcissistic, I guess, than to assume that you have something to say and that somebody else should be paying attention to it? But I don't think very many people end up being artists unless they have the belief, rightly or wrongly, naively or not, that they really do have something to say. I think one of the great things about being an artist is you can go to the grave unsuccessful, totally unsuccessful, and still feel, well, you know, that someday they're going to figure out that what I was doing was really good. Most of us, when we die, when there's no one left to talk about us, that our presence here on Earth dissipates and ultimately will disappear. But artists leave behind residue and evidence that they were here. And there's a little bit of immortality in that, you know?
You talk about memorializing your work as an artist, and luckily people have recognized Chuck Close while you're still alive, so you don't have to go to your grave hoping that people will appreciate you, you know, in the next century. But you've also memorialized your face. You've done a lot of self-portraits.
Yeah, way too many, probably.
But there is a self-love there a little bit, because you said before that you paint people whom you love and whom you want to stare at for months at a time. Mm-hmm. Why have you done so many self-portraits?
Well, I like myself. I don't think I'm particularly attractive, and I try not to flatter myself. I'm not vain. I think being bald since I was in my 20s and not looking the way I wanted to look my whole life made me less vain, perhaps. But at any rate, I do one self-portrait usually with every body of work. So about every 9 or 10 paintings, I'll do one. And it's sort of a touchstone. And it records my loss of hair and my changing eyewear. Since I don't do commissioned portraits, I don't have to flatter the sitter. The sitter, in an act of tremendous generosity, lends me his or her image with no control over what I'm going to do with it. And because they're not paying for the painting, they can't ask me to fix their nose or straighten their teeth or get rid of their zits. So if I'm going to be particularly truthful and honest about someone else's face, I have to be as ruthless and non-flattering when I paint myself.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch, and I'm talking to Chuck Close, the painter of heads. He started off doing more photorealistic paintings, and he's moved on to his famous incremental paintings. There's a story you once told. This is after your illness. You were at the museum, I think at the Met, looking at Van Eycks and Vermeers, and you were really impressed by the motor control that these people had to make their paintings so precise. And you were really depressed because you weren't able to achieve that ever again because of your ailment. Well, you tell the story.
I have a friend who said to me, because I was paralyzed from the shoulders down, and at that point it didn't look like I was going to regain any use of my arms. But the thing that I was really going to miss was the physicality of pushing pain around. So at any rate, I'm in the hospital. I'm trying to figure out how I can still make art. And my friend said to me, "You'll be all right because you paint with your head and not with your hands." And I thought, easy for you to say. What a Hallmark card thing to say that is. But in fact, it was true. In fact, it turns out that my fingers and my wrists don't work. And I paint with brushes strapped to my hands. But when you paint with your whole arm. Drawing requires wrist and fingers. And that's usually done on a horizontal surface. But painting, because it's done vertically, you sort of paint with your whole arm. The comment about that you're referring to came from the fact that early on, I was initially very upset that all the work that I loved the most in the museum was incredibly, usually very small, very detailed, with a great deal of virtuoso art marks. So I find myself sitting in the studio and painting away, listening to music, and I'm so happy. I'm singing along with the music, and I realize that while I'm singing, there are tears streaming down my cheeks. And it was a simultaneous loss, a sense of loss, that I had lost something that was very important to me. And at the same time, a celebratory experience that I was so happy being back to work and making things that matter to me, that I could, in fact, have both of those experiences and both of those feelings, crying and whistling, going on at the same time.
And you did really have a chapter two in 1988, and you had some allies then, just as you had allies in your earlier days, through the Walker Museum and through
the
Whitney.
Never get anywhere without mentors or supporters or whatever. These are and I've had them all through my life. Actually, one of the things that really mattered a great deal to me was when I spent 8 months in the hospital and I got out, I worried a great deal about having been seen as a handicapped artist. I never minded being seen as an artist with a handicap, but I did not want to be seen as a handicapped artist. It was extremely important for me that a few people in my life who were really important to me helped me. One was the late curator of painting and sculpture at the Modern, Kirk Barnardo, who visited me often in the hospital, and Aggie Gund, who was the chairman of the board of the Modern, who visited me often. And they ended up buying the first painting that I made when I got out of the hospital. And that good housekeeping seal of approval of the Museum of Modern Art behind this work said to the art world, he's back, and the quality of the work is as good as it was before he went in the hospital. Obviously, the Museum of Modern Art is not going to buy an inferior work just to cheer me up. And that sense of the art world pulling for me was extremely important. The curator, Robert Storr, who did my retrospective at the Modern after I got out of the hospital, also did something that was very interesting. He took work from the last exhibition before I went in the hospital and the first exhibition after I got out of the hospital, and he mixed those works together in one large room. And the point being that there was no difference. Well, I'll tell you, the intervention of other people in your life often makes all the difference.
So now, just being in your current stage in life, you've been painting for five decades at this point. Do you think you'll continue doing heads?
Well, I never would have guessed 40 years ago that I would still be painting heads portraits today. And I am surprised that it still has urgency for me, and it still is. I find that's sustaining. the decision that I made initially that has allowed this to happen was after I made the first portrait heads, I thought, okay, now what am I going to paint? And I thought, well, now I'll paint apples or bottles or landscapes or something. And I thought, well, if I change the subject matter, I'm not going to change what I'm doing in the studio. My activity will stay the same, and so that will eventually become routine and ordinary and whatever. So I decided right then that I would keep the same subject matter and try to change other variables.
The process.
And the process, the technique, the materials, the scale, and that by so doing, I have kept myself engaged in what I'm doing because I changed the activity. I changed what I'm doing in the studio. And as someone pointed out that the difference between me and, say, someone like Jackson Pollock was that Jackson Pollock did not know what his next painting was going to look like, but he knew precisely what he was going to be doing in the studio the next day. And conversely, I know what my next painting is going to look like. It's going to look a lot like the photograph that I'm working from, but I don't know what I'm going to be doing in the studio. And so, much to my surprise, 40 years later, I'm still finding new ways to skin the cat. And if I'm still engaged in what I'm doing and it still has urgency for me, hopefully it will still have urgency for the audience.
Well, thank you, Charles.
My pleasure.
My guest has been the American painter, Chuck Close.
Coming up, we'll meet Peter Thiel, co-founder of PayPal. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Thiel, the co-founder and former CEO of PayPal, an online payment system where anyone with an email address can send money using their credit card or their bank account. In 2002, eBay bought PayPal for $1.5 billion. Welcome. Typically, it's striking to me how when entrepreneurs start out launching a company, the company they set out to launch looks a lot different from the company it becomes ultimately. And I was wondering if you are a victim to that type of evolution.
Well, we started the company in late 98, and we launched the initial PayPal product in the fall of 1999. And I would certainly say that the very first year, we went through a number of different cycles in terms of trying to figure out what we were going to do. We started with security technology on mobile devices, a wallet, sort of a mobile cell phone payment system. And then in the summer and early fall of 1999, we stumbled on this idea of linking money with email. And I think you're right. This is not an unusual kind of a way for things to develop, especially at the very early stages of the company.
My understanding was that you went out to venture capitalists initially to try to raise money for this encryption software called FieldLink. And you weren't being very successful in raising that money, so then you then decided, okay, well, let's start a company called Confinity, which does provide payment options using the internet.
Yes. Yeah, we went through several different names early on. There was a FieldLink, then there was Confinity, and then we hit on we actually hired a naming company, and they came up with 1,000 different names, and we liked PayPal the best. But yes, so we did iterate through a whole bunch of these things. I probably spoke with had maybe 100 separate meetings with venture capitalists or more in the course of 1999.
How did you meet your partner, Max Levchin? He's from the Ukraine, mm-hmm. and he was a programmer since he was about 10 years old. How did you and he come into contact initially?
I was giving a talk at Stanford in the summer of 98, and we talked afterwards and became friends, and basically he was trying to figure out how to start another company. He had already started a few of them back in college at University of Illinois. I was actually in the process of I was running a very small fund at the time and helping invest in various companies and things like that. We basically started working together. I was going to help him find a CEO, so I helped him interview various people. And then at the end of the process, he asked me to be the CEO. And I said, well, you know, I'll do this for a few months till we get somebody else. And it then evolved into a four-year commitment. It was quite an extraordinary time.
What was your lecture, by the way, about at Stanford?
It was related to international finance or something like that, which is my background had been in finance.
You spent quite a lot of time at Stanford. You went to undergrad at Stanford, and then you went to Stanford Law School. And while you were at Stanford College, you started the Stanford Review, which is a libertarian conservative paper.
I had gone to Stanford for 7 years in a row, and so there was a whole set of people from that area that I was, you know, pretty familiar with, and had worked together. And it was actually one of the great things when we started PayPal was there were a lot of people we were able to hire from out of that network.
You're talking about the importance of community, which you really found in Silicon Valley and in Stanford. But it's ironic to me because it seems like both you and Max, to some degree, had quite a nomadic upbringing. Can you tell me a little bit about where you're from and how you got to California ultimately?
I was born in Germany. My parents emigrated to the U.S. when I was about a year old. We lived in Africa for a few years. And so I ended up going to about 7 different elementary schools, which is kind of a lot. But from about junior high school on, we were living in Northern California. Max was born in the Ukraine, as you said, and his parents emigrated to the U.S. when he was 16 years old. And as Max liked to put it, they left in August of '91, which is in the weeks when the Soviet Union disappeared and was replaced by Russia. And so he was a citizen of no country.
What was the impetus for your family to move to the
U.S.? My dad was just doing some master's college work in the U.S., and so he was an engineer.
And what was your mom doing?
My mom had been working for an airline, but then basically became a homemaker when my brother and I were born. And, you know, our family was sort of extremely – all sorts of things about everyone's family that are kind of eccentric and strange and interesting. But I think we were very, very focused on education. I remember one anecdote when I was growing up in fifth grade. My mother concluded that we weren't doing enough work in school, and the teacher wasn't pushing us hard enough. So one day, you know, she showed up in my class and just sat in on the class all day to see what was going on. And the various kids were saying, "Oh, your mom's here." And, you know, anyway, so I think it was a good thing on the whole.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. And my guest today is Peter Thiel, the co-founder and former CEO of PayPal, an online payment system where anybody with an email address can send or receive money using credit card or their bank account. There's a quote about you. Actually, you said, every month you think you're going to die, and every other month you think you're going to take over the world. And this is an emblematic of your sort of roller coaster ride with PayPal.
I don't know if that's something you have at every single company. I think a lot of them do feel like that on the inside, where it is a bit of this extraordinary roller coaster. And I think PayPal was an extreme version of this, and it grew at a rate of about 5 to 7% a day, compounding daily. So compound math is very powerful. So, you know, by mid-November, we were up to about 1,000 people. By the end of 99, we were up to 12,000. By February 2nd of 2000, we were up to 100,000. By mid-April, we were up to 1 million.
How did you achieve that growth?
Well, we had some initial bonuses that we gave people to sign up. And then in January of 2000, we noticed that a lot of people were starting to use it on eBay. And so we developed a lot of features that were especially targeted for the eBay auction market, and you know, where you had both people who were both buyers and sellers, which meant that you'd send money to someone and they would turn around and they'd buy something from somebody else, and so it was naturally sort of this incredibly viral place where you got phenomenal growth rates. So that was the good thing. The growth was just, you know, off the charts. And then of course there were competitive issues in that large parts of the payment industry, are fairly, nothing ever changes. You have sort of Visa, MasterCard, the Visa, MasterCard duopoly saw as a threat. There were government regulatory questions about how what the regulatory regime for this was. So this was a completely new payment system. So was it a bank? Was it a money transmitter? You know, what were we? And what regulatory box did we fall in? You know, our initial position was, well, we shouldn't be regulated at all because we don't fit into any of the boxes. And then eventually we pushed for being regulated as a money transmitter, similar to Western Union, which I think is probably the correct box. And of course, that's much less regulated than, say, a bank.
So let's dissect that a little more, this Western Union notion. Ironically, I feel like you are innovative in that you are actually using cash to move around from buyer to seller, whereas other companies who were innovating were using, you know, cyber cash or digicash or replacements for dollars.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you thought initially of using those cash replacements, or from the inception you said, okay, no, we're going to be a little more old school and use actual cash.
One of the things that was a benefit when we got the company started in 99 was that there had been a whole slew of internet payment companies that had been started in the very first wave of internet companies back in 94, 95 that basically thought you were going to create this new electronic currency on the internet. And by 99, they had all sort of floundering for one reason or another. The most biggest one was people were just not using them. And so, you know, the question was, you know, why give someone cyber cash? You know, we could give you a chicken, or we could give you, you know, Malaysian ringgit, or we could give you a U.S. dollar. And in fact, currency is a massive network phenomenon. And, you know, the reason, you know, a $100 bill is something that you would like to have is because there are other people who would like to have that $100 bill. And so we're much better off giving you something which leverages off this already pre-existing currency network than trying to start a completely new one from scratch.
What did you do to incentivize people to adopt the service initially?
Well, we initially incentivized people by giving them referral bonuses.
Of how much?
It was about $10 if you signed up and $10 if you referred somebody else who signed up. So it was $20 per customer acquisition cost.
And were these all your friends initially?
It was initially the people at the company, and then they got other people to sign up and just rolled out in concentric circles like that. And you know, we initially were thinking, you know, this is crazy spending, giving people $20 to get them to sign up. But I realized that it was cheaper than all the alternatives.
How did you even have the cash initially to give $5, $10 per person? Where did you get that capital initially?
Well, we went through a whole series of venture capital financing rounds. Nokia was one of our early investors. We originally started with this sort of wireless small device focus.
How much did they invest?
They invested
initially
about $3 million. Then we had another financing round late 99. But then in early 2000, March 2000, as the service was taking off, we raised about $100 million, which turned out to be quite a fortuitous timing. People, you know, they were lining up to write us checks because it was, you know, at the very peak of the boom.
But then that turned very quickly.
Yes.
So you were very lucky to get
yes.
in to
yeah,
raise
closed,
that money.
We closed the $100 million round on Friday, March 31st. And I remember it was the next Monday the market basically collapsed.
I want to go back to the competitive situation. There were a lot of companies that came and went before you came on board, but there was one competitor that stuck and that might have been a formidable foe for you guys, and that was X.com. What were they doing that made you pay attention to them?
There were a number of people who launched these services around the same time. And basically, Confinity, which had the PayPal service, and X.com were the two that had launched them at more or less identical times and were both growing very, very quickly. It was, you know, this ferocious competition. They were four blocks down the street from us in downtown Palo Alto.
Did you know them personally?
We didn't know them personally, but, you know, you sort of had, you know, you had a meeting every day where you were exhorting the engineers to, you know, work harder. And it's a somewhat disturbing a kind of human nature. I'd never seen people work as hard as, you know, when it was like, you know, the enemy is four blocks away. You know, both companies were spending money at an exponentially growing rate. You know, our customer base was growing exponentially. We also had exponentially growing burn rates. And it turned out we were both kind of freaked out about it. And so we finally decided in early March to do this 50-50 combination between the two companies. which had all sorts of challenges. So, you know, each company had about 60 people. You combined them into one company with 120. So it was like you hired all of a sudden 60 people that you hadn't interviewed. But it was worth it, if for no other reason than that gave the company the necessary momentum to raise that $100 million in March of 2000 that then carried the combined company to profitability.
Whose decision was it to merge with X.com, or at least to start a conversation with X.com? Did you say one day, okay, I'm going to go down four blocks and knock on their door?
It was December 31st, 99. I was on the internet. I decided, well, I have to actually get an account on X.com to see what our competitor is doing. So I signed up the account, and 10 minutes later, the CEO from X.com called me up and said, oh, I said, welcome to our service, and then suggested that we should maybe talk. And we ended up getting together and over the next few months figuring out a way to get the companies to work together.
I want to talk some more about the competitive situation, about the credit card companies and the banks. Why did they look you over initially?
I would say there were two things. One was that the whole thing happened incredibly quickly. So, you know, you have to realize nobody was expecting a new payment service to arise in, you know, a matter of months. And then I think the second part of it was that, you know, at the end of the day, we did not actually take away business from Visa or MasterCard. If anything, we expanded their business because we enabled people to use their credit cards in contexts where they'd never used credit cards before. And so, yes, some of the larger payment companies would have preferred to capture this market for themselves entirely. But at the same time, it was not as though there were people working at these companies whose jobs were being threatened if we were going to be successful, because this was just not a market they were in at all. It was a completely new market.
When you first met Max and you understood that he had a good computer programming acumen, how were you convinced that his technology and the technology that you were building was ironclad and was more secure than everybody else's? I mean, because that is really the heart of your business, is
yes,
to be able to transact in a very secure, protective way.
Well, there were several technology challenges. I mean, one was obviously to make the thing scalable so that you could serve millions of people and it wouldn't break. And Max had actually built some scalable systems before, so we're pretty confident on that score. The security piece was a bit trickier in that, you know, we didn't quite appreciate all the security challenges that we would have. In some ways, had we appreciated them, we might never have launched the company. And it's not like it's a single tech problem to solve. It's more like this iterative process of dealing with all kinds of different very creative people in, you know, Russia and various other places trying to figure out new and improved ways to steal your money. You know, there were conventional ways you could have solved it by requiring, you know, enormous amounts of information about each customer before they used the service. But that would have just basically made the service unusable. So you have to sort of look at the fraud problem in the context of some of the other challenges, such as the convenience challenge. And so the real issue was this trade-off between how much fraud would we tolerate versus how inconvenient did we want to make it for customers.
That's right.
If there was no trade-off, you could have stopped the fraud pretty easily, but you would have pretty much shut down the service too. And this was actually one of the challenges a lot of the large banks had. They were very focused on the fraud problem, but they ended up creating services that were basically unusable. And I think that ended up being one of the most valuable technologies that actually was developed. It was certainly not what we thought was going to be the core technology, but it turned out to be a core competitive asset just because people were not willing to enter the business because they didn't understand the fraud problem.
We did talk before about eBay becoming a surprisingly good complement to PayPal. And after you went public in 2002, eBay bought you shortly thereafter. How long were you public before eBay bought you?
Well, we took the company public in February of 2002, and then eBay announced the acquisition in July, 5 months later, and then it was completed in October towards the end of 2002. So we had had conversations with eBay for a number of years before then. There clearly were enormous synergies. It was very difficult to know what the right value of it was. Once the company had been taken public, there was sort of a market valuation on it, and then it was much more straightforward at that point to negotiate a deal with eBay.
How much money did you raise in the public offering?
We raised about $70 million. We'd raised about $220 million in private capital beforehand.
I've heard before that you think that PayPal is linked to sort of international peace or prosperity. And I was wondering if you can narrow that down a little bit more. What do you mean by that? Let's say
that's so megalomaniacal. You know, I think that if we can have a system in the world based on trade instead of people fighting each other, that would be sort of make for a much, much better world. And that's, you know, I'm very much in favor of free trade, free movement of capital, you know, trying to help people forge commercial relationships across all sorts of geographic and cultural barriers. And I thought that sort of the critical part of the infrastructure for that is a seamlessly functioning global payment system. The T-shirt slogan was, PayPal was the new world currency. And I think that turned out, you know, we didn't quite live up to that, but I think to the extent we've pushed the envelope a little bit more in that direction, I think it has made the world a better place. I really do.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me, Jesse.
My guest has been Peter Thiel, the former CEO and co-founder of PayPal.
To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.